on RN and online. You're listening to Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Continuing this evening's theatrical theme, we're off now to Canberra for the best bits of the keynote address at this year's Australian Theatre Forum. A conversation, actually, between an anthropologist and a futurist. They'll challenge your preoccupation with the here and now and ask you to take a few risks and imagine the future. Lenore Manderson is Professor of Medical Anthropology at Monash University. And Kirsten Alford is a futurist with a PhD in engineering and founding director of Bridge 8, a foresight agency which also creates animations. For the last 3 years, they've been working on the Academy of Sciences Australia 2050 report, exploring social perspectives and biophysical limits of what a future Australia might look like. Here are the highlights of Do We Even Have a Future? With Lenore explaining first up what anthropology can bring to the way we think about the future.
I mean, historically, anthropologists have been so connected with the past and with tradition that people routinely assume that all anthropologists are actually now called archaeologists and we deal with bones or other kinds of forensic things, usually with societies that no longer exist, or collect fragments of language that are dying out. And historically, meaning for the last century or so, most anthropologists do work on around tradition, around culture, around cultural continuity, around resistance and at best resilience, rather than around imagination, aspiration and hope. And the change has probably been over the last 40 years or so, when increasingly we've worked on questions of the present, not the least of which has been because many of the peoples with whom we've worked have assumed that anthropologist equals colonisation or colonialism equals not a very good idea. And so we've turned to our own societies, and of course now anthropology is not a discipline of colonialism. But more importantly, I've been reading a book by an anthropologist called Arjun Appadurai, who's now was in Chicago and is now in New York, in which he actually takes anthropologists to task and asks why we've paid so little interest in the future, other than in terms of things like millenarian movements, some work on risk as not in terms of taking risks for a future, but risk as kind of a category of human knowledge construction and how people mitigate against risk rather than take risks. I mean, that's sort of a very small point that he makes. But in reflecting on that, it did occur to me that what most of us did in anthropology was the anthropology of now. And we do the sociology of now and the politics of now. And in his book, Appadurai actually says that economists, I mean, it appalls me to say this, economists are one of the few academic disciplines that are concerned with the future.
Well, it's interesting you talk about economists because the book that I've been reading that's sort of prompted my thinking about this is by Nicholas Taleb, who wrote The Black Swan, if any of you have read that, which harks back to the famous story about the discovery of the first black swan in Western Australia. And they took that specimen back to the Royal Society in England and they classified it not as a swan but by another bird because black swans didn't and therefore couldn't exist. And when they realised that it was related to the swan, not only did it change the way that they classified animals, but it also, people said, well, of course that was going to happen. And of course it wasn't going to happen. It was completely unexpected, it was completely new, it was completely unknown. And so Taleb's written a book called Anti-Fragility, which is really about, and the reason I mention this now is because he's very critical about economists and takes them to task over the fact that they are constantly amplifiers of the noise and not of the signal, the really important things, that will change us. And I guess in that argument, you know, the noise that we hear through the news of today, the nowness of today, our expectations that we can predict and anticipate how the future's going to go are false, because what really matters and what really changes the way that we think are those black swan events, those things that fit into the unknown unknowns category of the Rumsfeldian quadrant, if you're familiar with that quote. The things that we can't anticipate and that we can't expect. And so when thinking about the future, there's this interesting dilemma. Are we thinking about the future to anticipate and to predict what may happen, to take advantage of it, Or are we preparing ourselves to take opportunities and to be more robust to the things that we can't anticipate and can't expect? And that question about do we even have a future, I think, is a really useful one. You know, there were groups of people who were working on the biophysical limits to where, and those are quite clear, you know, there are some limits at which we've pushed beyond the space in which the Earth can provide us with our needs, and we can model those limits and we can assess those limits. But from a social perspectives angle, it's much harder to assess those limits, because if you go to the limit, it's death. Okay, so you don't want that. But where then is the space of risk? Because for some people, they are able to tolerate, you know, very large risks or very uncertain, unhappy circumstances that would push people, other people, over the limit. So it's a very iffy space.
It's so culturally bound too. I mean, the now is what all of us are experiencing in our own lives. I mean, we can't even project to another population. We're so centred on who we are. I mean, we also don't even extrapolate to the most obvious examples, and it's not, you know, what would it be like to live in a slum in India, which some of my colleagues could talk about at length. But when I first went to Tokyo in 1988, Tokyo in a city was about 12 million. All of Tokyo was 23 million, so Tokyo urban area was the size of Australia today, and that's 25 years ago. Bit more. Tokyo Metro now is 37 million people, and almost very few people in this room would have lived in Tokyo, if anybody, and it would just be fascinating to get a whole lot of people who are making decisions not just to imagine but to actually live in that kind of environment, to force them to come to terms with the way in which things are moving. I mean, I find the questions around population awful to revisit, because I mean, I do remember very clearly the discussions around future shock and limits to growth and so on, and then following on from that, a sense that, well, that must have been exaggerated, and it really doesn't matter that the world doubles itself every X number of years. But clearly it can't keep on doing that, and it does it exponentially for very obvious reasons. And to begin to imagine a future not about, well, how do we control population, because that's a very segmented response, but, well, what else is going on, and how ought we be acting now to ensure that there is a future, and what kind of policies do we need in place that are outside the usual ways of doing things? And I think one of the sticking points, as opposed to the tipping points, the sticking points for decision-making and policy is the processes are so rigid, and the processes are old, tried, true ones. I mean, the only thing I do differently today than I did as an academic 40 years ago is that I write more reports explaining what I've done.
No, it's really interesting you talk about the Tokyo and that urbanisation process, because I think sometimes you and I've been talking a lot about lack of imagination, and I think it really does, to put ourselves into those different types of futures for Australia really does take a stretch of imagination, and many people struggle with this. Mm. So we're coming back to this question about how do we make the future as real and as tangible as the now, so that people can act on the decisions. And the sort of things that we're talking about, I've just realised we sound depressing, and we're falling into this classic future is dystopia. There is a project that was recently launched called Hieroglyph, and I'm going to get the university, I think it's Arizona State University, which was specifically designed to encourage science fiction writers to write more positive views of the future. And so Bruce Sterling, Neil Stephenson, a couple of other fairly, Brenda Cooper, some fairly well-known science fiction writers are in that space engaging with scientists and other artists from a range of disciplines to find out, well, where are the points for positive sign? Now, one of their projects is to build the tallest tower ever possible, which sounds like a very, I don't know, male thing to want to do. But I like this idea that we might be trying to find more optimistic visions. So one of the things that came out for me from the last tipping point was, look, and it didn't go anywhere, but the idea was to find positive views about the future and climate, and to sort of, you know, go away from smokestacks and polar bears and find positive views or images of hope that we could use. So this idea about hope, I think, how do we bring that into our conversations?
It's hope, but it's also aspiration in a more tangible way, and the willingness to take a long-term view. And I think you're right that I mean, maybe the cost of things like debates around limits to growth and future shock and so on were that we did freeze at that point and think, well, there's not much we can do about it and someone out there will resolve the problems and then we've abrogated. It's not our responsibility. You work as a futurist with people to make everyday decisions. So how do you guide people to make decisions and how do you help them think about the future in a way that makes sense to them?
Yeah. Well, and I think hope is a really good example of the thing that I find I do best as a futurist is to give people frameworks for having structured conversations. We've already talked about how difficult it is to move, you know, beyond ourselves. So as an example, I run a project where I ask people to think about what their life looks like in 2035. I do this with classes of people, you know, from year eights to University of the Third Age people, which is an interesting discussion. Where will you be in 30 years' time? But the interesting thing about asking people about those futures is that they are so ordinary. Their capacity to really think beyond a normal trajectory is very limited without a structure. So I still remember one year eight boy who said to me, in the year 2030, I'm going to be married to Stephanie. I'm going to drive a red Corvette. I don't know if he'd spoken to Stephanie about this. I think she was in the room. I'm not sure that he'd discussed this with her. But just those ordinary futures. So how do you help people move outside those ordinary futures to start to appreciate what really does change over the course of a lifetime and how things might change? And so one of the techniques we use is around hope theory, which is to say, to move in a positive direction, you need that positive, alluring, aspirational image that makes people want to move, you know, that gives people a sense of what might be possible. But the image itself is not sufficient. You need also agency and pathways. So agency says, yes, I can do that, I can make that happen. And pathways says, I can make it happen no matter what obstacles I run into, I'll find a different way. So someone with a lot of agency and no pathways is the person you see banging their head against the brick wall. You know, someone with lots of pathways and no agency is the person who has many, many ideas but never moves off their butt. So you need those three things, really, to help people move towards the vision of the future. And then you also need to understand what it means for them. You know, how is it relevant for them? How does it connect to them? And how does that make people move forward?
Then, you know, following on from that, it seems to me like one of the dilemmas for people, if you say in 30 years, we worked on a project, Australia 2050, that's 36 plus years away. And yet we talked about it as if it was beyond our imagination, rather than working on the assumption which begins, well, we'll still be alive. I mightn't be, you will be, but I may will be. And if we actually understand that we will probably all live till we're 100 or so, I mean, if with sufficient medical interventions to keep us going, then what kind of life do we want to have then? And if one did that and looked at how people who are 100 live their life now, then it actually pushes you to start making plans and to start changing things yourself because you think, hang on. If the world stood still now and I just got older in the same world, would I want to be at that point there on that basis? And we kind of do a little bit of that thinking anyway when we do something like take out insurance, contribute to superannuation, those kinds of worries, where we're actually battling, you know, what we're talking about, this sort of intense focus on now, versus thinking through, and then relating to that, of course, is also our dependence on other people to make those decisions. And we live in a democracy, of which there are not that many in the world. There are probably 30-odd, of which half of them aren't functioning very well. But when everything seems to be done by government, and if government isn't doing something about our future in 30 years, it's too hard. And, you know, in that context, the only parts of Australia... I'm not surprised about your thing about science fiction writers. The only parts of governments that seem to me to deal with the beyond now at present are the Departments of Defence... globally, because they are thinking we don't want this because we want to be like that downstream, therefore it's worth spending the equivalent of small nations' global budgets in order to have war. And relating to defence, of course, in the past at least, space exploration. And space holds this imagined place where we can go and escape and live in either utopias or dystopias, depending on which space we end up in. So that does take us into it. But countries invest in space. Now, why on earth does any of us support money being spent on space research when it's unproductive in contemporary parlance, as opposed to simply boosting the national budget by X amount of dollars, which is very concrete and is the same kind of concrete theory that increases jobs or increasing the number of, or keeping a factory going is concrete. And so that the challenge that you're talking about is really to how to get people to think pragmatically and realistically about the unknown and the unknowable. We actually don't know what life will be like in 2050, but we have to work on the assumption that it doesn't matter that it's unknowable, but it's our job to be working towards it.
Yeah, I actually think defence and space are really two different things for the following reasons. I think there is a lot of the knowable in the defence. You know, it's trying to anticipate. It is trying to sort of lock down all of the variations in order to ensure a specific preferred future. And so a lot of the work that we do with government isn't about exploring possibility. It's about the minister does not like surprises. You know, it's about making sure that we know exactly how the future is going to unfold. I think the beautiful thing about space is maybe it stems from that, but it doesn't actually help us be pragmatic or sensible or work out what's going to happen. It releases the imagination in such a way. And maybe less, you know, maybe it's less that than it used to be, you know, and maybe there was that sort of sense of discovery and going on. But you only have to follow Commander Hadfield on Twitter if you've been doing that. Am I talking to an audience who knows this? I've got a couple. Okay, so he's a Canadian astronaut. He's been on the space station for 5 months, returned a couple of weeks ago. For those 5 months, he would tweet photos of the world as he travelled around the globe. And somebody said he should be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm totally in support of that, because you see those images of us all living on this tiny little planet, and you start to really get this sense of that connection and that system and the way that we live in a way that is far beyond the pragmatic, but is in a, you know, really visceral, emotional sort of sense of what it means to be. So I think space holds for us. I think the purpose of thinking about the future is not to nail it down and to be able to anticipate it. I think the purpose of thinking about the future is to free ourselves, to have that broad imagination, and in doing so, we become more able to deal with the things that are unknown. We care less about the small things that currently upset us, the Australian dollar, and we care more about the big things, the things that I would hope would continue. You know, I heard Robin mention this morning things like wonder, awe, love. You know, those are the things that I think opening up our imagination to the future privilege and make important, as opposed to the very small things that we get carried up in the now.
Then the question relating to that is how any of us move to that, and what stops us as a nation, as well as individuals or a particular community of interest, from getting there. Because you know, one of the things that worries me is how little we've really changed our style of government in terms of how we relate to government, not in terms of how government does its business. Over the past century or so, you know, here we are, and we're in a very, very small country with a federal government and with state governments and with local governments. And you know that if it was ever taken to, you know, the only way we can change that way of governing is to change the constitution, and the states will never declare themselves out of existence, which from my point of view is not a good thing, because I don't quite get the point anymore of states, other than that it's another layer. But there seems to be a lot of lethargy and entropy that's going on, that is because we are so passive about being governed and about other people making decisions, and have lost a sense of our right to self-determine through both what we do as individuals and through any kind of activism. And so then it does go back to coalitions and what we're doing to move those agendas forward.
You know, again, it comes back to visions of hope. You know, if I had a student in one of my foresight classes who had been fighting actively the environment fight for 20 years, and he said, I'm tired. I'm just really tired. So I think there's a fair bit of that. You're fighting the same fight. I think there are, you know, new concerns, so things that we have taken for granted in terms of, you know, you and I had this discussion, have we reached peak comfort levels? You know, we've reached peak oil, peak phosphorus. Have we reached peak comfort? And where we could pass on a better life to our children, you know, if you do more education, you will get a better job. You know, if you have, you know, these sorts of comforts, you will get better housing, you'll be able to save. Have we reached the point at which we can no longer promise better futures because of the present that we're in? I think that's the question, and that's a question that's just too hard, so it's better just to ignore it and go back into our happy little nows. So.
Yeah, it isn't that it's too hard, it's that, okay, this is the best, so we're just going to keep on keeping it like this, rather than saying, recognising how many people don't get the best. I mean, So few of us actually, you know, 1% of the world's population maybe enjoys whatever is best in across countries. Kristen, do you want to do some wrap up?
Yeah, I do want to do some wrap up. So the first thing, as a futurist, I often get, oh, you're living in the future, you don't understand the present. And I just want to come back to your part. It is absolutely about understanding the present. It's just understanding the present from a much broader range of perspectives. You know, and I think that comes back to your point. We're not going to resolve things if we keep looking at the world the same way. We need to understand how the world is now, but from a much, much broader view. We need to change the lens on how we look at things. And I think we need to change the lens on who we give power to. So this point about hope taking a battering, if we continually give power to the people we expect to be our leaders and they disappoint us, we should move to where we give power to. And so, you know, one of the ways to do that is to ask why, what matters, to get to the very bottom of what's critical and to raise the things that we can share and have in common. Because we may find then that there is hope beyond the future government. It may only last 3 years. Or, you know, we might find another way, or we can give power to something else with agency and not assume that government is there to rule, but it's just an administrative thing. I mean, I think there's ways of reframing so that we can find new hope. So when our hope takes a battering, we need to be able to step back and try and find a different perspective or a different way of viewing. The other thing that came to me is Taleb recommends the barbell approach to action, which is don't try and do everything from the middle. You need to have some things at one end which mitigate against the risks where you will be very, very hurt if things go wrong. So, you know, make sure you've got a safety catch so that you're not hurt, or change the things that you get hurt about, you know, reframe them. And then make sure at the other end you take enormous creative risks. You fall in love. You move cities. You do something where the downside is minimal and the upside is unlimited. And I think if we, instead of getting ourselves stuck in the middle of where we think the future will go, the barbell approach to me is quite liberating. I am not an optimist. I really struggle. I fall into I think the world is going in a direction I don't like, and I feel powerless to stop it often. But there is a lovely book that I read by Meg Wheatley which says, when we feel like that, the only thing we can do is act with compassion and insight. Insight to understand the world better and to understand it from a range of perspectives. Compassion to work with empathy and love. And so that would be my recommendation for when hope takes a battering. Go back to compassion and insight.
I mean, really what we've been talking about to some extent is a butterfly effect, which is a sort of fairly trite cliche, but it's not irrelevant about butterflies flapping their wings. But if you go beyond that, tragedies, you know, are not always parables of the future. They can simply be our recall of enacted histories of days gone by, and that we have to build on them in order to. So, I mean, all of our parables, even the imagined ones of the future, are based to some extent on the past, and we've got the capacity to change. And that's certainly true for artists, because that's what artists are really employed to do, is to take risks in a way that maybe not everybody are able to. But we're also ambassadors for the future as well as the present, and we're spokespeople for alternatives. And I'd like to think that everybody in this room has a claim or an aspiration to claim, but I think we all as humans claim of moral authority and leadership in a general sense, if not a practical sense. And following on from that, the philosopher I like most is Levinas, and Levinas talks about the fact, not that I think, therefore I am, or I am I, therefore I am, but that we are who we are by virtue of our relationship to others, and that if you are in my here, then I am responsible for you as a human, and that is the price of being human. The Zulu version, and there are similar words throughout a lot of African languages, is Ubuntu, I am I, through you. But there's another African statement that I want to finish with, which is, when you pray, move your feet, which is rather like the indigenous English version of walking the talk. And I'd like to think that this conversation is the beginning of us moving our feet. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Lenore Manderson, Professor of Medical Anthropology at Monash University, and Kirsten Alford, futurist and founding director of the foresight agency Bridge 8. You've been listening to highlights of Do We Even Have a Future?, the keynote address at the Australian Theatre Forum held recently in Canberra. Our thanks to the Forum's Antonia Seymour for making that recording available to us.